So I'd like to talk tonight about the Dharma Gates. And as often is the case in these events, by the second, or in longer events, third, fourth, fifth night, the talks tend to have a subtitle. The subtitles tend to get goofier and goofier as the days go on. So this one is not goofy at all, really. It's actually quite appropriate, I think, to the title of the talk, The Dharma Gates. And the subtitle is Weaning Back into Freedom. Whether you know it or not, we have been not only experiencing the teachings, but giving the teachings. In our time together. And I mean that very, very directly and literally. Who you are, what you are, how you are, right now, is influencing the teachings. The teachings would not be happening in the way they're happening without you. I could sit here and think up a talk like the Dharma Gates and start talking, and it wouldn't be the talk that's going to happen here now if I was sitting in this room by myself. Something might come out. I'd be the only one hearing it. I'd be trying to entertain myself, which is a really hard thing to do. It's much easier to be entertained by others. And there would be no dynamic interaction like there is now. So the first Dharma gate is that we are going to give the talk. And so I'm kind of preambling here, yeah. I'm prefacing what I kind of called a surprise. So I'm kind of giving it away a little bit. It goes like this. I will pause at points during this talk, and I'll invite you to speak. I'll invite you to say the next thing that needs to happen in the talk. And it's possible that a bunch of silence will take place and no words will be spoken, or words will come out. Now, I can't make a rule because I already told you that I got in trouble for doing that. But if I was going to make a rule, what I would say is, when I pause and invite you, if there's something there, you have to say it. But that's not a rule. It's just a possibility. Thank you. You know, there was a talk that the Buddha gave once, a very famous talk with no words. Some of you might know it. There was a flower next to the spot where he sat down. It was a really large group in the assembly that evening. And the way he gave the talk was, he said no words, he just picked up the flower and he held it up. And there was this monk down in the front. Kasapa was his name, Mahakasapa. Mahakasapa smiled. And the Buddha put the flower down and left. Now, there were folks in the assembly who were upset by that. He didn't speak. What was that about? They didn't understand it. You know, they got upset. And then there were those who completely understood. And I think it's relevant because not only one of you took the time and effort to go and get this and put it here, and thank you very much for us, but also because apparently Jesus said, look at the flower. When he said, look at the flower, I don't think he meant analyze the flower. dissect the flower with your mind, figure out the, you know, components of the flower, analyze it, take it apart, understand it with your mind. He said, it was a metaphor, you are a flower. Which is even more to the point than be the flower, or be like the flower. Some of you may know the even personally, probably in our time, the world's greatest mythologist or gatherers of myth, Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell, towards the end of his life, was being interviewed on the radio. And it was a rather young and feisty interviewer. And, you know, they were having a good exchange. And then at one point, the interviewer, towards the end, it was probably about 5 minutes left in the interview, he decided to kind of go for it. So he said to Campbell, he said, what's a metaphor? And Campbell was spot on. He knew right where he was at, so he's going to work the counter question. He said, if you're going to ask a question like that, you got to answer it first. Put the guy right on the spot. All the listeners are out there. Time's running down. This guy's on the spot. He can't throw it back and say, no, I asked you. No, he's got to answer, right? He put it out. So he tried. He went, okay. The boy runs like a deer. Campbell shook his head. He said, that's not the metaphor. The metaphor is the boy is a deer. First Dharma gate. The metaphors. Everything is literal and symbolic simultaneously. We are sitting in Indra's net. Indra's net is a profound and subtle metaphor for the nature of reality. We are sitting in Indra's net. And it's not dependent on your posture, your alertness, whether you have a tummy ache or not, whether you think you're doing well or not, whether you believe you're getting anywhere or not, whether you like what's happening or not. Regardless of age, of gender, of preferential tendencies, of biases and opinions, of fixations and addictions. With all of that happening or not happening, you, we, us, this, is Indra's net. First Dharma gate. Let me explain. Tusan lived 557 to 640. That's a good number of years in those days. Got close to 100. Listen carefully. The net of Indra is a profound and subtle metaphor for the structure of reality. Imagine a vast net. At each crossing point, there's a jewel. Each jewel is perfectly clear and reflects all the other jewels in the net. The way two mirrors placed opposite each other will reflect an image in infinity. The jewel in this metaphor stands for an individual being, or an individual consciousness, or a cell, or an atom. Every jewel is intimately connected with all other jewels in the universe. And a change in one jewel makes a change, however slight, in every other jewel. Thus, by liberating yourself, you liberate all beings in the universe. Or, from the opposite direction, once someone asked Gandhi, while they praised him for his compassionate politics, "What are you doing?" He answered, "I am here to serve no one else but myself, to find my own self-realization through the service of others." If we just heard that first part of the sentence before the comma, "I am here to serve no one else but myself," sounds like total selfishness. What self? What self is he serving? It's the jewel in Indra's net. See, this talk needs you. Otherwise, this talk would not be properly called the Dharma Gates. In fact, this talk started earlier today because someone requested something. It's going to happen in this talk, the request. Will have a response. Traditions are very powerful and they're very helpful. But if we're honest about things, really, and we look at the history of liberation, it happens when the human goes beyond tradition, goes beyond what was said and done before. We are the living tradition of humanity with the potential to go beyond at any moment. I love traditions. I was raised in one. It was very powerful. It actually gave me the gift of spirituality before I knew anything about what it was. But traditions are also potentially limiting because we start to place ourselves in it and somehow there's other things that are different or outside even. It's a fact. It's a fact that I don't know how many there are right now, but the number is a disturbing number. Wars on the planet right now, the primary fuel for the war is beliefs about the truth, beliefs about God. What a strange phenomenon. I said at the beginning, somewhere in there, this is the only world we know. Every other world is an imagination. But there's a hidden world in this world. There's a hidden world in this world. And we're going to see if that hidden world wants to become more visible in our talk tonight. Are you helping it happen yet? If you don't think so, let me suggest to you, quite, you are. I'm going to be speaking about freedom, and I'm going to be speaking from freedom. Notice the difference, if you like. Freedom is the only game in town. If you're in Hawaii, it's the big kahuna. It's the mana. If you're Paul Revere, it's give me freedom or give me death. If it's John Adams and the other so-called founding fathers of this country, not to mention, while I mention him, the genius Thomas Jefferson, who taught himself to play the violin without any instruction, among other things. It's the Declaration of Independence. People want it, and they want it so bad. They're fighting really hard for it tonight. In Syria, in parts of Africa, in Iraq, across the river, and right here. The fight, the struggle, is really subtle in this room. There's no weapons, no arms, no bombs, no harsh words being exchanged, no brute force being applied. But it's the same game. Because intrinsic, inherent, inside the human being is a desire for happiness and peace. And why happiness and peace? Or if it's not happiness and peace, in a psychological sense, many times, it's just the sense of wanting to love and be loved. And sometimes it's, if you love me enough, or in the right way, then I can open and I can love you. Or sometimes it's, I'm going to try to love you as best as I can so that then you turn around and love me back. So this exchange opens up so that there is a flow of love. And what's the love, peace, happiness thing about? It's about freedom. So freedom really is the only game in town. And either there's a sense that it's happening to some extent, or it's not. And if it's not, then we often engage in how to open it up. Whether it's with the body or the mind, the emotions, the expression, the behavior, the activity. It's either happening or we're seeking it. And there's fine gradations in there, very fine gradations. We're living in this very tiny band of relative equilibrium or balance in this sphere. Very, very subtle. And we're extremely vulnerable. At the same time, we're durable. Do you know that the fascia, the connective tissue that surrounds the brain and the spinal cord, the meninges. The outermost meninge is called the dura mater. That's Latin for hard mother. The dura mater has the tensile strength of a Michelin tire. I don't care whether it's a Michelin truck tire or a Michelin car tire. A Michelin's a Michelin to me. Plenty of resiliency. We're incredibly durable and yet we're incredibly vulnerable simultaneously. The realization of that so-called opposite dance in terms of what? How it feels to be here is itself a Dharma gate. See, we don't remember very well what it was like when it wasn't okay to simply be lying there on the floor or the cushion or the bed, and we cried and someone came and picked us up and soothed us. But it happened. We don't remember very well what it was like to gaze out of these eyes and have no conceptualization of an other out there. There's many things we don't remember. And we don't need to remember all those kinds of things that happened to this body-mind. What we need to remember, though, is in the direct experiential sense, why this body-mind is really here. And what I would put forth for our contemplation is that this body-mind is here primarily, fundamentally, for the possibility of awakening. Because if you live a life, whatever number of years it is, 70, 80, 90 or more, and you don't have the good fortune, as I spoke about last night, through the precious human birth, it isn't just getting a birth, but having access to authentic spiritual teachings, then you've lived only half a life. It's not wrong or right, but you've missed something. As one of my teachers said, the human being is born like an egg coming out of the hen. The egg is in a shell of ignorance. The spiritual life, the spiritual awakening, the second birth, the rebirth, the born again experience is the cracking of the egg, and out comes the chick. We're the chick coming to the surface. And this shell of ignorance itself is a Dharma gate. What is your shell of ignorance? First opportunity for you to speak. What is your perception of your shell of ignorance? Attachment. What is your perception of your shell of ignorance?
Fear.
If you feel the fear, when you say fear, then the shell is already beginning to break. If you feel the vibration of the energy of what you call attachment, when you say attachment, the shell is already beginning to break. If you say the word attachment or fear, and you don't feel the resonance of that word in the body, in the belly, in the heart, then you'll have an opportunity later. Because you were up here when you said it. Anybody else? What is your perception of your shell of ignorance?
What I think I know.
You mean rather than what you really know? Is there a difference between what I think I know and what I really know? You see, freedom must include freedom of speech, right? Don't postpone. You don't have to ham it up and come up here and knock me off the cushion and give the rest of the talk. But don't hold back is the invitation. You see, we have to honor, we don't have to do anything. We can honor the tradition and nudge it open a bit more. You know that in certain parts of Asia, even today, when a nun has the teachings moving through her strongly enough, the community, which still to this day is sadly at times governed, or should I say reigned, by the patriarchy, they'll put the woman behind a board and she'll give the talk to the community behind a board. One of my wife's teachers, Christina Feldman, when she was a nun in Asia, actually did that. She gave the talk just as she was told to behind the board. Interesting, huh? When the Dalai Lama heard about the oppression in the monasteries in parts of Asia, he just broke down in tears and wept and said, "I never knew it was that bad." You see, even a so-called tradition that's about enlightenment, holding such bias, such prejudice, such division. We're exploring, to the extent that we can in the short time we have, the fundamental spiritual teaching of and for humanity. This is not a Buddhist teaching, Hindu teaching, Sufi teaching, Christian, Judeo-Christian, Jain teaching. It's a universal teaching. Sure, it makes sense to pull from different places, pull from different traditions. But when we begin to find the hub in the center of the spokes of the wheel, and we begin to realize that we actually are the hub, not as a separate individual, but that we're the jewel reflecting into and from all the other jewels, then we're touching this fundamental spiritual teaching. Another Dharma gate. The word Dharma, I mentioned it the other night, means different things. We've heard the word, many of us. We've read about it. We feel we understand it. What is the Dharma? The Dharma is the laws of nature, the law of impermanence, law of karma, cause and effect. How about the law of love? There's an unspoken law called the law of love, that if you love, then that will connect to the law of karma, and life will be enhanced. If you hate, if you fear, if you grasp, if you hold on, if you generate jealousy and don't look for what feeds it and believe your jealous mind, you will sow seeds and you will experience that world. The Dharma, particularly when we talk about Dharma as nature, the natural world is the Dharma. The sky, clouds, the grass, the river, the ocean, the streams. It's so interesting that most of us are drawn to nature, if not wanting to be closer to it, ever closer to it. Can I figure out a way to live my life and be so close to nature that I feel like I'm never leaving it? More than a few people, after the genocide, and it was a genocide in Cambodia, many people who survived that genocide lived for years afterwards in small wooden huts and would grow singular tomato plants outside their huts with singular tomatoes that they would eat. And that was their nature. It's no mistake that many, many monasteries and meditation centers actually are sitting on beautiful areas of the earth, mountaintops, by rivers, by the ocean. But make no mistake, they're in the cities too, in the middle of the cities. Make no mistake, Dharma as nature is happening right now on the giant pile of garbage in the city, massive city of Manila in the Philippines. There is a pile of garbage, stuff that we throw away. It is a mountain. You can drive a car on it. The BBC reporter went in to interview or find somebody to talk to in this community that lived on the mountain of garbage. He drove his car up to the top, and as he got up there, some of the people who were living up there just moved away. One woman in particular did the opposite. She went straight towards him. I would imagine she intuitively knew why he came. And she said, "Come and let me show you my home." Imagine this, a home on a mountain of garbage. These are people who are existing on what we throw away. And she took him into her house, which was made of scrap plastic, pieces of tin, and wood. And there was a plastic table with a plastic chair, a plastic vase, and a plastic flower in the vase. And he reported that she shared this with him with such openness, love, and a sense of pride. This is my home. So we think Dharma as nature. Oh, it's the perfect color grass. You know, it's the turquoise Caribbean sea. It's the perfectly clear blue sky. And of course it is those things, but not just those things. The natural world always already free. The natural world always already free. No sense of I or self, me or mine in the flowers. Some of you know and maybe appreciate the poet Rilke. I like Rilke very much. One of my favorites, in fact. Rilke talks about many things, but he talks about friendship, among many things. He talks about how your true friends are important, to find who are your true friends. And he speaks about it in a way that suggests your true friends are friends who guard and protect your solitude, which to me means they guard and protect your meditative awareness. They guard and they protect your enlightenment as they protect their own. Even if you only have one such friend, that might be all you need. Here's a quote from Rilke. We say release and radiance and roses, an echo upon everything that's known. And yet, behind the world, our names enclose, is the nameless, our true archetype and home. There's a Dharma gate. This world, as you know it, this relative world, is a Dharma gate into the archetypal world, the invisible world. The world where words become less and less important and finally not important at all. Most of us have so much freedom already. But like I was suggesting last night, we can take this freedom we have for granted very easily. Very easily. We even feel that what we have is not enough. That we want more, we deserve more, we need more. And we're not going to be okay, we're not going to be satisfied, we're not going to rest, we're not going to sleep well until we get more. I always liked the Dharma talks the best because then I didn't have to meditate. At least I thought. It was like a chance to kind of sit back and go like this. Except the only problem was I was sitting initially in an environment which I called the boot camp militaristic Dharma environment, and you weren't allowed to go back too far. You certainly weren't allowed to lie down. So I was doing one of these during one of the Dharma talks. And one of the managers came right up and got both hands under my back, and he went, see, we're only about 25. When you put 100 or 150 or 200 or 300 people together doing this stuff, you got to have managers. People need to be managed. You know, and if you start giving them a chance to write notes, the notes start flying around, and they're sending notes to one another about the teacher and about the food and about the bed, and all of a sudden the faucet's not right. You know, and it doesn't smell good anymore, and somebody's wearing perfume, and shouldn't there have been a rule about that? And it starts opening up, and this neurosis starts to appear. This collective neurosis, and some people are just laughing at it, and some people are getting serious. This is really serious. Wow, you know, I can't breathe properly because you're wearing perfume. And then there was the day when they decided to say, stop wearing those kind of like raincoat things that make sound. All of a sudden somebody decided that that wasn't okay. You had to get rid of that. Meanwhile, the teachings are coming out about freedom and Dharma gates and weaning back into freedom, and this neurosis starts coming out. So many stories I don't have time to go into. Most of us have so much freedom already, and yet we're not okay still. We don't have enough. They asked Rockefeller, at that time, the richest person in the world. I don't know who the richest person is now, but I would suggest it's not the person with the most money. The richest person in the world with money at that time was Rockefeller. They asked him, how much money is enough? He paused. And then he held out his hand and he moved his first finger and his thumb across one another. And he said, just a little bit more. So you begin to see that the Dharma gate clearly is not a material thing. It's not an acquisition. It's not something that you get. Because if you think there's something to get, then you're always vulnerable to that which you will lose. If you're looking for something that you think you don't have, you're looking away from what it is that you are. If you think someone else has it and you don't, and you're pulled towards that which you think they have and you don't, you're looking away from what it is that you're really looking for. However, if you're lucky, and it is luck, that which you're looking at in the other being may just possibly reflect back to you like Indra's net, the jewel therein. And you begin to see in your own being what it is that you thought was only over there. Until we begin to realize that this is not about freedom from, but rather this is about freedom amidst. This is about freedom within the unsatisfactory, insubstantial, unreliable, uncertain nature of our daily lives. And so let's begin to go into what this actually is, this freedom amidst, this freedom within, the insubstantial, the factual nature of relative reality. Insubstantial, unsatisfactory, because it can't bring, none of this can bring a lasting happiness, can it? How can an insubstantial thing, something that by nature comes and goes, how can that thing, that experience, bring a lasting happiness? Logic would say it's impossible. Rightly so. Insubstantial, meaning the substance that this is not staying fixed, put. And how about the uncertainty and the unreliability? I can't even get what I sometimes think of as my best friends, not my true friends, my best friends. I can't even get them to call me back when I want them to. Never mind the old-fashioned letter that came with the handwritten pen or pencil. Nowadays, it's a text message that's got 6 words spelled wrong. Oh, don't worry, you can figure it out. Just read it 3 times. And if you don't have my number captured, I love that one, then you're just going to have to retrack and try to figure out who I am. It's all moving so fast. It's scary. I said to my son, he's 18. Before he moved out a few months ago to go to college, I said to him, okay, there's this movie somebody told me about called As It Is in Heaven, and it's made in Sweden, and it's subtitled, and I want to watch it tonight. Hook me up. He said, come on in here. Turn your computer on. Sit down, watch. This is 18-year-old. Sit down, watch. He's talking like that. We don't have Netflix. Didn't work. He keeps going. I can't even follow how fast he's going. He goes, there it is. Streaming. He goes, click that. Watch it whenever you want. I said, can I come back in a couple hours after dinner and watch it? He says, yeah, just click right there. Watch the movie. If I said to him, slow down so I can take notes, he'd say, I don't have time for that. You gotta pay attention. Freedom's moving pretty fast, Dad. You gotta pay attention. You see, I wanted to know how he did it. I didn't just want to watch the movie, because then I told somebody else about the movie and they said, how did you get to that movie like that? And I said, I'll have to talk to my son. It became a problem. It's about freedom amidst, not freedom from. In our minds, we think freedom is a thing. And sure enough, feelings can feel free, and thoughts can move freely, and sensations can flow freely, and breath can be moving freely. It's all part of freedom. But what am I speaking about when I say freedom is not a thing? What I'm saying is that freedom is a realization. Freedom is the realization of the way things really are. The way the feelings and the thoughts and the sensations and the perceptions and the consciousness, the way it really is. The way these five elements, the earth, the water, the fire, the air, the space, that's what this is, the five elements, the way these things really are. Realizing that is the freedom. That is the second birth. That is the cracking of the shell of ignorance. That is what frees our heart to really love. Right here in this form. Everything is changing. I keep saying that, don't I? Watch this. Everything is changing. No thing lasts. Freedom is not a thing. Freedom is not an object. Therefore, said another way, freedom is actually not an experience in the way we typically connote experiences. So what is it? I've been pointing a bit, and if we had more time, the pointing would continue, and it would become continuous at a certain point here, at the nature of awareness. Because the nature of awareness itself is that which we have access to continually, because it's what we are. That is the ongoing, simplest, most direct, immediate, ever-present Dharma gate. Doesn't need to be thought about, doesn't need to be figured out. All that's asked or invited or encouraged is that it be allowed. the awareness that is sitting in this room, that these bodies are sitting in right now, is free as it is. It is open. It is spacious. It is without center or circumference. It is non-dual. It is whole, complete. And it's loving, peaceful, and happiness all at once. In Tibetan Buddhism, it's called Rigpa, R-I-G-P-A. It is the original true nature of mind. It is what is recognizing any and all experiences that are arising, all things that are occurring, all insights that happen, all changes, all phenomena, is being recognized by something. This something is not a thing. It is the immediate Dharma gate that all other Dharma gates come from. It's childlike, it's wonderful, it's light itself. Notice it right now. Notice the possibility of awareness of awareness. In the Zen tradition, it's sometimes called the backward step. Instead of going out towards the world and experience and things and this and that and all that we call the unfolding life, just resting in that which sees. Because what we're looking for is actually hidden in the one who's looking. It's so simple. Because of the dross of the conditioned mind for so many beings over so many millennia, these very simple words were held back. Even in the Dharma that came to Tibet from India, in the year 747, brought by Padmasambhava, the words, like words I just spoke, were whispered through holes in caves to other caves, because if these words were heard in the openness of the community, they were blasphemy. They would have brought death because they were too radical, too immediate, too instantaneous in their freedom. This is the truth. Such a strange thing. To grow out of our childlike wonder, perhaps for the purpose of being able to rediscover it and truly know it. Because it's rare for the two-year-old who's sitting as the Buddha nature to realize that Buddha nature. Thus, it makes sense that we probably need to experience some trials and tribulations Because the pearl beyond price, as the Sufis say, the pearl beyond price asks everything from us. It asks for our full care and attention. It asks that we not forget about any other beings, because they're all part of that with us. It's the most fundamental thing. It's the most personal and yet interpersonal and transpersonal thing that we share, this awareness itself. Now, your turn. What is awareness to you? What is awareness to you?
Coming out of the fog.
And while it may be coming out of the fog, he said, awareness is coming out of the fog. Awareness is what sees the fog. How about even more juicy, right down into the kiss with the fog? Awareness is the fog, isn't it? Isn't that the boy is a deer? Awareness is the fog. We'll come back to that. We have time. What else? What is awareness to you?
Feeling no separateness.
Is the feeling of no separateness drifting about in this room? Doing the tango with the feeling of separateness? You can't have one kind of feeling without the other. That's how they come. And interestingly enough, they come in pretty much equal proportions for many of us. Now, I said this to somebody the other day. I said, you know, that's the way it is. Every sadness is tempered by happiness, and every happiness is tempered by the sadness. And she responded right there. She just went boom. She said, well, listen, I've had my share of sadness. Now, where's the happiness? I've paid my dues over here in the sadness. Now, I want equal happiness. Put me right on the spot. I said, well, I wasn't quite meaning it like that. See, because she was evaluating it and saying it had to be the way she called the scale. Life's got the scale running right through you as you experience yourself. What is awareness to you?
Unspeakable knowing. Mm.
How is awareness known?
This.
This. And that.
And that.
Observing the unfolding of phenomenon.
Observing. So it's observing.
Acceptance.
Awareness is accepting, isn't it? Awareness takes no sides. That's why it's unbiased, it's non-judgmental, it's non-preferential.
Mm-hmm. Letting go of expectations.
Is that what awareness is?
For me. Mm-hmm.
Feeling that someone wants to say something. it over here? No?
Well, I was going to say similar to what you'd already said, so I'll say it.
Yeah.
It's being with what is without judgment.
Yeah.
Acknowledging what is.
Being with what is without judgment. Better that you said it than me. Notice how it feels to talk in here. Do you like it? Do you feel like you're kind of shifting things around, doing it different? Maybe it's easy for some of us. Some of us have no fear of public speaking. Others of us have more fear of public speaking than dying. Paul Revere, stage 2. Give me death over public speaking. You're looking at one who was born with tremendous social anxiety, fear of speaking in front of people, even one person. If the number went to 2, the fear seemed to double. The whole body contracted, the breathing tightened, words wouldn't come, throat was there. I was a clinical basket case. And yet there was something there that said, you know, it doesn't have to be like this, because I started looking at others. There it is, the mirror of possibility. I started looking at others and see, other people don't seem to be so afraid. I started to meet people. I remember there was a guy at a party in undergraduate college, and he was talking about physical culture. And he seemed so relaxed, his hands just rested, and he seemed so easy, and everybody seemed to like him. And I was sitting over there on the side, unable to say a word, but yet observe the possibility of my own freedom in him. You see? If you can't see it when you close your eyes, and if you can't see it coming out of the pages in the book, and you can't hear the freedom in the silence of the wind blowing, then you can sometimes see it in other beings. And if you don't feel unworthy to go on the journey of discovery, because that's what's going to be required, the journey of discovery, which sometimes can get quite dark and lonely, then you, in your own way, in your own time, can wake up to that which has been mirrored to you. How come Maha Kassapa could smile in seeing the flower, and the Buddha, I would imagine, knew the teachings were complete for the evening? Because he saw the reflection of liberation in the flower. The request from Debbie was to talk about the practice of dying. Am I close? Really important. This practice we're involved in is the practice of living and dying. The opposite of death is not living, or the opposite of living is not death. The opposite of death is birth. There is no opposite to living. Thus, I will recommend a book. If you do not know this book, I recommend you read this book as soon as your life allows time. It's called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. Take your time with it. Read it carefully, maybe several times. Be in no hurry. Do a page a day or less. It is an absolute gem. It is so important. It is a revelation. It is worth every single word in it. So here's a little bit of a taste. Some of you may have read the book already. Are you interested in how to die consciously? Because if you're not, then you're missing the Dharma gate. The process of dying is explained in considerable detail in different Tibetan teachings. Essentially, it consists of two phases of dissolution. An outer dissolution, when the senses and the five elements dissolve, and an inner dissolution of the gross and subtle thought states and emotions. This is the Dharma gate appearing. But first, we need to understand the components of our body-mind which disintegrate at death. Our whole existence is determined by the elements: earth, water, fire, air, and space. Through them, our body is formed and sustained, and when they dissolve, there is death. We are familiar with the outer elements which condition the way in which we live, but what is interesting is how these outer elements interact with the inner elements within our own physical body. And the potential and quality of these five elements that also exist within our mind. Mind's ability to serve as the ground for all experience is the quality of earth. Its continuity and adaptability is water. Its clarity and capacity to perceive is fire. Its continuous movement is air. And its unlimited emptiness is space. The following explains how the physical body is formed. This is from an ancient Tibetan medical text. This is not based on people sitting around and analyzing it from their brains. This is coming direct from an empirical experience. This is a phenomenological study. This is meditation. The sense consciousness arises from one's mind. The flesh, bones, organ of smelling and odors are formed from the earth element. The blood, organ of taste, tastes and liquids in the body arise from the water. The warmth, clear coloration, the organ of sight and form are formed from the fire. The breath, organ of touch and physical sensations are formed from the air. The cavities in the body, the organ of hearing and sounds, are formed from the space. In short, writes Kala Rinpoche, I'll come back to him, it is from mind which embodies the five elemental qualities that the physical body develops. The physical body itself is imbued with these qualities, and it is because of this mind-body complex that we perceive the outer world. You see, there is no outer world without the five senses that touch it. And the outer world is in the inner world through the conduit, the Dharma gate of the five senses. Children know more about this experientially, not intellectually, than we do, because we've lost touch with this simplicity and we live in the world of abstraction. Thus, Kala Rinpoche said in his last teaching on planet Earth, one of the first Tibetan yogis to come to the West, he said, we live in the world of illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality and you are that. When you see this, you see that you are nothing. Being nothing, that's awareness. You are everything. That is all. Now, let us hear about Kala Rinpoche's passing. But first, statements like, death is the moment of truth, or death is the point when we finally come face to face with ourselves. We've all probably heard that in one form or another. And we have seen how those who go through a near-death experience sometimes report that they witness their lives replayed before them. They are asked questions such as, what have you done with your life? What have you done for others? All of this points to one fact. In death, we cannot escape from who or what we really are. That means our true nature. This is designed to eradicate the fear of death. Because it is the fear of dying that is the fundamental veil over the Dharma gate of liberation. The idea that I, as I experience myself, will die, and I don't want that to happen, therefore I cling to myself. Mm-hmm. Now watch how this works. Whether we like it or not, our true nature is revealed at death. But it is important to know that there are two aspects of our being that are revealed at the moment of death. Our absolute nature and our relative nature, which means our relative nature is how we are and have been in this life. As I have explained, in death, all the components of our body-mind are stripped away and disintegrate. As the body dies, the senses and subtle elements dissolve, and this is followed by the death of the ordinary aspect of our mind, which is a great relief for some people. With all its negative emotions of anger, desire, and ignorance. Finally, nothing remains to obscure our true nature. As everything that in life has clouded the enlightened mind has fallen away, what is revealed is the primordial ground of our absolute nature, which is like a pure and cloudless sky. The reason why we're meditating, in part, is to see and know ourselves as this cloudless sky, because the more and more you become familiar with it, the more and more you will be prepared to see it when the relative nature falls away. And so what we're doing here as we sit is experiencing bit by bit dissolution of the relative nature so that the true nature, the Rigpa, yeah, the luminous ground of being, awareness, can come through. Do you see what I'm saying right now? That's why meditation, proper meditation, correct meditation, is the practice for death. What is called the dawning of the ground luminosity or clear light, where consciousness itself dissolves into the all-encompassing space of truth. Now, the Tibetan Book of the Dead is what this is drawn from, and this is much easier to read than the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So here's Padmasambhava, who had the great fortune of bringing the teachings from India to Tibet in the year 747. Listen to how he writes. He's so playful. This self-originated clear light, which is the beginning, was never born. It is the child of Rigpa, that's awareness, which is itself without any parents. How amazing. This self-originated wisdom has not been created by anyone. How amazing. It has never experienced birth, and it has nothing that can cause it to die. How amazing. Although it is evidently visible, there is no one there who sees it. How amazing. Although it has wandered through samsara, no harm has come to it. How amazing. That's what's happening. We're wandering through samsara, and yet no harm has come. Although it has seen Buddhahood itself, no good has come to it. Flips it. How amazing. Although it exists in everyone everywhere, it has gone unrecognized. How amazing. and yet you go on hoping to attain some other fruit than this elsewhere. How amazing. Even though it is the thing that is most essentially yours, you seek for it elsewhere. How amazing. So now, because of time, I'm chewing it up too fast here, and I'm over time already. And you didn't talk enough. Two more things. Kala Rinpoche passed away in 1989 in his monastery in the Himalayas with a number of masters and doctor and nurse present. I want to read you how it happened. Notice your heart and how it may respond to this. Kalu's closest disciple wrote the following. Rinpoche himself tried to sit up and had difficulty to do so. Lama Geshtin, feeling that this was perhaps the time, and that it was not right to sit up, that it would create an obstacle for Rinpoche, supported Rinpoche's back as he sat up. Rinpoche extended his hand to me, and I also helped him sit up. Rinpoche wanted to sit absolutely straight, both saying this and indicating with a gesture of his hand. The doctor and nurse were upset by this, and so Rinpoche relaxed his posture slightly. He nevertheless assumed a meditation posture. Rinpoche placed his hands in meditative posture, his eyes open, gazed outward in meditative gaze, and his lips moved softly. A profound feeling of peace and happiness settled on us all and spread through our minds. All of us present felt that the indescribable happiness that was filling us was the faintest reflection of what was pervading Rinpoche's mind. Slowly, Rinpoche's gaze and his eyelids lowered and the breath stopped. If you can't die sitting in meditative pose, then it's recommended that you lie on your side in lion's pose. This is how the Buddha supposedly passed, with a hand on an elbow and the other hand on the thigh. These are things we can learn, and we can learn them now. Because, like Don Juan said to Carlos Castaneda in the mountains of Mexico, death is always over your left shoulder. We're flipping from the inside out this negative preoccupation, this fear, this aberrance, this aversion, this strange inverted clinging to death through the energy of fear. Flipping it inside out and recognizing the possibility of awakening in death. There's some real heroes in the world of Dharma, present, past, and future. Padmasambhava is a hero. And so one more passage from him. It pertains directly to the teachings of our hours here. It pertains directly to the pristine, naked, open, free, spacious ground of being, which is awareness itself. It pertains to the intimacy that's holding us right now in Indra's net. The non-separate, whole, fulfilling nature of this unconditioned awareness that we are. Listen. Since there are no two such things as practice and practitioner, if by those who practice or do not practice, the practitioner of practice is sought and not found, therefore the goal of practice is reached and the end of the practice itself. That deserves a second go. The mind can actually get that just a little. It's really designed to turn the mind upside down more than the mind understand it. I'll read it again. Since there are no two such things as practice and practitioner, no separation between practice and practitioner, no two such things, if by those who practice or do not practice, the practitioner of practice is sought and not found, therefore the goal of practice is realized, and also the end of practice itself. You see? We're all in it together. Therefore, there are no spiritual practitioners and so-called unspiritual people. And he goes on. The uncreated, self-radiant wisdom of your original mind, actionless, immaculate, transcendent over acceptance and rejection, is itself the perfect practice. Now that is the most succinct statement I've ever heard about the true nature of awareness. No one left out. Nothing to get. Nothing to get away from. Notice that the nature of awareness itself is accepting, allowing, beyond your ideas of acceptance and rejection. Because if rejection can arise, it must be being allowed by something. And our mind and its conditioned tendency will split acceptance and rejection and take it down, 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 down to the most subtle gradations and say these are two different things. Meanwhile, there is that which allows both freely and equally. Is this clear? It's called by many words. The one I'm most fond of is the great allowance. the allowance that transcends the idea of practicing acceptance and trying to not practice rejection. May all beings realize the true nature of awareness. May all beings appreciate the intimacy of sharing the truth. May all beings come to the awakening that opens compassion like a flower. Let's take just a minute or two to sit together and take some time for walking.